The great scientist, the professor, is the center of almost every story. That's natural, since it's the object to tell a human story. There are very few science fiction stories in which the central figure is not the great professor, at least one of the most important characters. The layman writer worships the great scientist as a superman. But the scientists writing scientific have been more than willing to go along. The scientists' description of themselves are either hypercritical or very flattering, one or the other. But recently, they've been extremely critical. Of course, they're the only ones that could do it, and science fiction was the only place they could get away with it. Some quite eminent scientists have been writing some scathing science fiction in which they show up scientists. Well, laymen couldn't do a thing like that. It'd just be sour grapes, as far as they were concerned. And where else could these men unburden themselves with impunity except by putting their speeches in the mouths of other people in fiction? Well, that's fairly safe. But that's an interesting trend of our times. He says, well, indeed, Thomas Kuhn has recently shown that the history of science is actually fiction, deliberately contrived to make science look good. The history of science itself is the foundation of science fiction. If every problem has a scientific solution, it's following from the Milesian school, you see, then God isn't wanted in any solution. See the original idea? Well, we can't bring God into the laboratory. We can't weigh him. We can't use him, so let's leave him out. He exists and all that, but we can't use him in our calculations. And before you know it, any problem can be solved without him, so he becomes impedimenta. He just becomes so much useless baggage. Science fiction uniformly describes life in worlds in which science is king, meaning the scientist, a world in which the dream of the sophist is fulfilled, in which there's no room for any but one kind of thinking. This is the one world of John Dewey, which he carried to its logical conclusion. Richard McKenna, a scientist writing science fiction, recently said, I am a positivistic, well, he's a geologist. I am as positivistic a science as you will find. The students blush and hate me, but it's for their own good. Science is the only safe game, and it's safe only if kept pure. The speaker here is, of all things, a geologist whose business is to reconstruct the past. That's why he likes to write science fiction. Need we say that any reconstruction of the past is 100% pure imagination, keeping science pure. Well, now, Bacon sold the Western world. It's happened before, but Bacon sold the Western world on the image of the super scientist, who has become the figure of scientific fiction, but never lived in real life. We find it now. He's calm, aloof, dedicated, unswayed, incorruptible, self-effacing, magisterial. Science is a superman as far above the savage, said Huxley, as the savage is above a blade of grass. Well, compare that with Levi Strauss's book, which shows that it's a lucky anthropologist who can even equal the savages of many a tribe for sheer intellectual power, knowledge, and things like that. the great science fiction by scientists deals with this theme, and the question, should scientists rule the universe? Who else? Here's Eric Temple Bell. These are some of the science people. In a story called The Ultimate Catalyst. Here, the pure-minded scientist does terrible things to a wicked dictator. This is all right because he takes the scientific view. As an idealist, the scientist is the necessary enemy of all bad people. This is the Baconian image of the pure scientist. And this one, J.M. Brewer, which has had considerable publicity, called The Gostek and the Doshes, it starts this way. And this is deadpan. He's quite serious. Woloshinsky, a great scientist, smiled indulgently. He towered in his chair as though in the infinite kindness of his vast mind there were room to understand and overlook all the foolish little foibles of all the weak little beings that call themselves men. A mathematical physicist lives in vast spaces. To him, human beings and their affairs do not loom very important. He's dead serious. We have a sort of Superman here. Now, here we get that Superman. The nearest thing to him is in the figure of Rutherford, as he is worshipfully described here by C.P. Snow. And Rutherford is his hero. He says, the tone of science at Cambridge in 1932 was the tone of Rutherford. Magniloquently boastful, creatively confident, generous, argumentative, lavish, and full of hope. Science and Rutherford were on top of the world. Worldly success, says Snow, he loved every minute of it. Flattery, titles, the company of the high official world. He was also superbly and magnificently vain as well as wise, and he enjoyed his own personality. Here, if ever, is the great lovable scientist of science fiction. What more could one ask for than science on such a level? He enjoyed a life of miraculous success, writes Snow, but then something strange follows. But I am sure, even quite late in life, he felt stabs of sickening insecurity. Now, this is strange, sickening insecurity in this man of all men. And then he goes on to talk about other great Cambridge scientists. Does anyone really imagine, he says, that Bertrand Russell, G.H. Hardy, Rutherford, Blackett, and the rest were bemused by cheerfulness as they faced their own individual state in the crowd? Great. They were the leaders. They were top men. They were worshipped. But by themselves, he says. They believed with the same certainty that they believed in Rutherford's atom that they were going after this mortal life into annihilation. Against this, they had only to offer, he says, the nature of scientific activity, its complete success on its own terms. It itself is a source of happiness. But it's whistling in the dark when they're alone. And he gives some very interesting sketches of the odd ways these people behave. Only scientists dare criticize scientists as demigods, and they only in science fiction, as we mentioned before, and some of them have been pointing out there. Now, J.B.S. Haldane, the only science story he ever wrote, a great British biologist, called The Gold Makers, shows that science is a key to power and gain, is likely to become a pawn to clever and unscrupulous men, that the scientist really isn't ruling the roost at all, that he will be victimized just as sure as anything and be used as a tool. And this has become a theme of much science fiction, of course. Julian Huxley, the only science fiction he ever wrote, and he was British, not his brother, but Julian, the biologist, in a story called The Tissue Culture King. The theme here is the superiority of the scientist to ordinary people and the right of science to meddle with all forms of life, including human. In a Saturday Evening Post for November the 6th, here is this article, "We Scientists Have a Right to Play God." And it's by, of all things, an anthropologist. "One has a right to play God, or play Hamlet, or play the organ before the world, only if he has the capacity to do so. So the question is, just how godlike is this man's capacity, you see?" And so many stories by scientists, fiction, explode this myth of our great capacity, because we break down to us, we hide behind our specialism. Well, I'll read you some passages here and show this. This man is an anthropologist. I wish I should have brought that very amusing essay on anthropologists by Parkinson, of Parkinson's Law. Well, and here's another one. Well, here's a good example of this, you see. But who's the scientist in this case? James McConnell, who is a psychologist, wrote a story called Learning Theory, which also is a very good one. It got a lot of comment. In this, we have a human scientist, a psychologist who thinks he's pretty hot stuff, but there is a much smarter psychologist from Uranus, the planet Uranus, or Uranus, if you want. I take it one or the other. And he studies him just as a bug under glass. You see, this man from the outer planet is so much more intelligent. Well, doesn't he? Isn't that the hypothesis? If we're the ones who know the answers, if we're the clever ones, we can cut up anybody we want if we're superior to them. And this is exactly the position taken in this story, in this new story of James McConnell, where the psychologist from outer space puts the human psychologist in a maze situation, which humiliates him, drives him crazy, and shows what happens to the poor rats when they're put in there. And what's more, this is the irony of the story. This wise man from the other planet completely misses the interpretation of the behavior of this animal from Earth. Of course, he doesn't impute intelligence to it or anything like that, but he has a theory explaining why this man in the maze, he has him in his chamber here, why he does what he does, and he removes the food from him and so forth, just as you would treat a rat. And this man knows what it's like, you see. Well, that's the answer to this. Does a scientist have the right to play God? Yes. If one scientist is superior to another, he has the right to play God with the other one. Everybody knows a little bit about science. We're going to draw the line there. But this is one of the things. You see, now here is a thing in which science fiction performs a useful function. You carry these things to their logical conclusion, to their ad absurdum, and you see what it leads to. This man should have had that in mind. A Nobel Prize winner has published a very amusing story on this theme, A.J. Gordon. He's a picture. He visits this super research center. And he says, if this is the picture of industrial research, what an indictment. They never call each other anything but doctor, and they have an agreement about not showing each other up. See, this is how the scientists get away with it. They project this image of Superman, and they agree that nobody will damage it with the public. See, it goes on. The person they wanted me to get rid of, this is the man who's running the laboratory, they wanted me to get rid of is the only one in the lab who really pushes his nose right down there and produces. But he isn't a guild member, no PhD, so they dared attack him. The people were nice and clean in lab smocks, very serious and busy. Over each door was a group name. Operations, research, physics, organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, the works. Each group had its own war, unlike special rabbits. Hurlbut, the manager of the thing, said, "We keep the strain pure here, and you know what happened to the collie. Its nose got sharper and its head thinner till its brains were pushed out through its ears. A terrible, terrible thing, but what can I do? They've all got families to support." The minute they're in the jam, my people scream for fancy instruments and tools, big enough to hide behind. Don't laugh, that's how we get big government research jobs. Monumental cyclotrons, well-behaved people to use them. God save us from competence. Isn't there one nut around? The board asked me why I didn't have any great men around, so I hired Cole and Hart, the Nobel Prize winners. I pointed out that Cole and Hart hadn't published anything in 20 years. Of course not, said Earl, but the Defense Department want competence. Their degrees must appear on a laundry list of people who will make up the task force. The Defense Department loves the expression task force. They eat it up. These two old Nobelorama gentlemen have put me over the top on contracts more than once. It's the star system. And in other words, what he's telling us is that the great scientists aren't all that cracked up to be here. Norbert Wiener, you all know who he is, in a story called The Brain, points out that man's moral weakness is his undoing. The story here is a great brain surgeon who operates on a criminal who's offended him grievously, and he makes a cut in the man's brain that makes him incapable of the clever judgment necessary to carry out his criminal activities, because the brain is a very smart criminal, see? Well, does he have a right to do that? The brain, man's moral weakness, you see. If we become dependent on scientists, we're at their mercy. And this, the doctor who's about to operate says he doesn't like the idea at all. He says, it's an ugly business and I don't like it. Sometimes it cuts out a man's conscience, and pretty nearly every time it does eerie things to his judgment and personal balance. He wiped the gang out, but this is dangerous. Listen to what this man writes here. Actually says this. We feel, he says, we feel free to exploit or destroy them as we think fit, all other forms of life. In contrast, we human beings habitually act as if other living species, animals or plants, exist only for our convenience. We feel free to exploit or destroy them as we see fit. It is true that some sentimental laymen have moral qualms about vivisection, but no orthodox scientist would ever have any hesitation about an experiment involving mere animals. See, here you are. We have the right to play God. Can we do this? This was that terrible story of H.G. Wells, the only one that ever kept me awake. I was a little kid when I read it. The Island of Dr. Moreau, where he does this very thing, you see. He cuts up animals, makes these terrible creatures with him. And here's one by Fred Hoyle, whom you all know, called The Black Cloud. And he says there, it isn't so much the volume of talk that surprises me among the scientists, it's the number of mistakes they've made. How often things have turned out differently from what they've expected. Well, they mustn't let the outsiders like us in on that sort of thing. But it takes a scientist to get away with something like that. And again, Norbert Wiener, in a story called The Miracle of the Broom Closet, in which he does bring religion in which he shows that just a little teeny bit of religion may have a very upsetting effect. He says, in a long career extended, this is his personal testimony here, in a long career extended over 40 years and three continents, I have never met the ideal scientist. This is the ideal scientist we're talking about. To upset a scientific experiment, all that requires is a very small miracle indeed. And with any devout and faithful servant praying, what can one expect, he says. But they're really cutting quite near the edge, you see. They don't have this, it's not this tremendous magisterial, this power and mastery, that the image that was projected in the early science fiction. And John R. Pierce, another scientist, in another famous story, is on the futility of mere quantification. This is what happened, he says, this is one of those after the Holocaust stories. In the world that experimental psychologists, he's an experimental psychologist, had pulled together from the chaos of nuclear destruction, no one cared to speak the obscenity that physics had become. Physics had become a dirty world, and physical scientists were taboo. They were hiding under rocks and bridges and things like that. The only people that were really respected were psychologists, and they were God now, you see. I don't know how ironic this is or not. He says, after the atomic blow-up, the experimental psychology men brought the remnants of the race together. They founded our civilization. They evolved our culture. No place for God in all this. We live in a world in which orthodox scientists, and this is a strange thing to say, refuse to see, or seeing, refuse to believe that which is before their very eyes. But a future that the open-minded, the perceptive among us have already foreseen is at hand. This is the way they talked about religion, see, a very short time ago. Now it's the orthodox scientists he's jumping on who refuse to see that which is before their very eyes. The dead hand of scientific orthodoxy cannot long delay. Coming future and so. The dead hand of what? Scientific orthodoxy? The antidote to science is more science, but it's my science, he says. Get rid of those awful physicists. They're going to destroy us and everything else. At the dawn of Western science, Heraclitus pointed this out very clearly. What many a science fiction, this very thing, is now discovering, that pure observation of Bacon is a myth. The scientist is a faulty instrument. He's a human being, after all, and he's going to make mistakes, and the world he gives will be his own, after all. The great scientist is not doing what he thinks he's doing, getting outside of the smoke-filled room. He's in it. He's taking his measurements there. We ring the changes on the same old bells, and every time we hit on a new combination, we gleefully announce that we've discovered a whole new set of bells. It sounds like it, but after a time, we begin to see that it's the same old belfry. Now, here, I don't know, Snow's portrayal of the great mathematician G.H. Hardy. He says here, he could not endure having his photograph taken. He would not have any looking glass in his rooms. When he went to a hotel, his first action was to cover all the looking glasses with towels. Of all mechanical devices, including fountain pens, he had a deep distrust. He had a morbid suspicion of mechanical gadgets. This is the great scientist, see? He would not own a watch or ever use a telephone. He hated all gadgets. His autobiography is witty and sharp with intellectual high spirits, yet it is a book of such haunting sadness, he said. The same thing. Because Hardy realizes with the finality of truth that he is absolutely finished, unquote. Well, now here again. Use these strange, haunted, strangely acting men. Notice science fiction worships efficiency. Naturally, it would in us bumbling amateurs. The superiority of the scientific way over all other ways. The scientist doesn't guess, he knows. The scientific mind was direct, clear, intense, trenchant, clean, unhampered by any defects of wishful or mythical thinking, recognizing only facts, seeing things always and only as others. Still, people that talk that way. There was no assignment that science fiction, that science could not carry out. But who gives the assignments? This came the thing. Nevertheless, this preoccupation with ways and means is another thing that science fiction has been helpful in exploiting. I mean, where does it lead us? Now, many years ago, the Edinburgh geographer Halford Mackinder wrote a book, which was, his student was Haushofer, and Haushofer, Hitler's advisor, based his Geopolitik on that. Geopolitics, that was the name that Mackinder gave it. And he has a marvelous section on ways and means there. He says the Germans always lose the war because they're so scientific. They know all about ways and means. They have everything figured out with the slide rule, everything to the sixth decimal place. They know just how to, but they don't know what they're after exactly. Just a vague idea of world conquest, so they always lose the war. The British bungle along, and they really bungle. They conquered half the world with a mere task force, with a mere token force, with a mere bluff, because they knew what they wanted. If you know what you want, you can always get it, he says. You'll bungle toward it, and you'll get it in the end. But if you just bog down in ways and means, you'll never get it. Well, science, he says, is preoccupation with ways and means, and science fiction's been that point first to point that out. In the Christian Science Monster, see what I'm thinking about now. Christian Scientific Monster, Christian Science Monitor, for February, very recently, just a week ago of this month, February 3rd, W.H. Pickering, the director of the Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech, said, "We are building communication systems very close to the ultimate you can ever get. You can use more power, but we are near the ultimate in performance." Ultimate is a strong word. What happens to unending perfectibility when we are already very near the ultimate? The realization that perfectibility lies in another direction, in another dimension. So Pickering says it's not a question of how difficult such exploration is. Ways and means isn't the problem. He says we'll always get the gadgets if we know what we want. And then he's speaking here of going even beyond the planets to the stars. The ultimate in human achievement, according to science fiction. But that isn't achievement at all, he says. The question is whether or not it's worthwhile, what we're doing. The question is not the question of business, industry, and the military, as Mackinder pointed out, of how to get a particular thing done. But what is it we are after? After all, when William Morris's student rushed to him with the breathless news that the cable to India had been completed, he merely asked, "Young man, what message will it bear?" When Einstein heard that the atom bomb really worked, he grabbed his head and said, "Oh, they. Oh, my gosh," he said, "terrible." Just smashed him. He wasn't thrilled at all. Ted Sirius today is causing a terrific rumpus everywhere. He's this guy who gets drunk, and then he can project images on film. Sometimes he can't, but sometimes he can. They've tested him all kinds. It seems that he can do it all right. But the mere fact that he makes images appear on film is considered a wonder, and it is. But what images? Nobody cares. British investigators, since Sir Oliver Lodge, have very firmly believed, received spirit messages. But what messages? Idiot gibberings and scribblings. The world makes a major issue over whether Joseph Smith really saw angels, possessed gold plates, or translated Egyptian. But they couldn't care less about what the angels, the plates, and the papyri have to say. For our age, the message is the medium because we've run out of message. A wise German scientist writing very recently in a journal that somebody gave me a subscription to some years ago, a German one called Cosmos, a pretty good for popular people like me. He wrote a very good leading editorial there, and the theme was that nothing could be more foolish than for science to do or make something simply because it hasn't been done before and can be done now. A few years ago, this would have been thought rank heresy. But why do we need to make all these things the important thing? We know we can do it now. Why bother? It's like the hunter who reached such a height of efficiency that he he now uses blanks or doesn't use shells at all, you know. He's not interested. There's a story about that, too. Because it's really not sporting anymore, as long as he knows it can be done. A cobalt bomb can be made. Is that any reason for making it? We used to think, oh, yes, think of the wonderful things we can do. Now, this going forward without knowing where we're going, unable to think of any other goal but more power and more gain through more power, is the way of insanity. And this, a lot of stories point this out. From tales of ecstasy, then, science fiction film, I'm going to hurry up here, quickly turned to tales of terror. Is there nothing in between? No, there isn't. Look at snow scientists, great scientists. They're manic depressive. They're either on top of the wave or they're in the dumps. Desperately haunted men. Because you are either going somewhere or you are going nowhere. If nowhere, no matter how great your eminence, how loud the shouting, it is but a brief, pathetic interlude, one moment in annihilation's waste. You're not going anywhere. The stars are setting in the caravan. Makes for the dawn of nothing. Oh, make haste. This G. Compton, in this collection of works by a great scientist, says, very few scientists write science fiction because real science is far more interesting. But the reason they have taken to writing it, first, for one reason, terror, for warning. They want to warn us, and they think this is a good medium for reaching the public. He says it's unfortunate they are not very successful. We're quoting now, he says, real science fiction by real scientists are strong and pertinent warnings on the dangers to society and certain applications of science or technology. And these soon are given up, however, because, he says, lack of impact of their first efforts at education through fiction. They think that this is their duty to the public, and they try their hand at it. For some reason, the stories don't cause the flurry they might, so they follow. But he says, no practicing scientist until well into the 20th century ever wrote science fiction. And then this little book here contains at least 75% of the science fiction written in English by science. But they're writing to warn us now. Science fiction has failed in the greatest promise of comfort and joy. Even Wells' scientific fiction becomes fascinating only when he turns his attention to the sinister and appalling. The scientist becomes the mad scientist before you know it. As in The War of the Worlds, the Island of Dr. Moreau, and so forth. If science fiction can show us no convincing glories ahead, at least it can give us this comfort and warning. And it's a dismal message. Now, if John Jacob Astor in his 19th century story could only think of aliens as inferior and dangerous, something to be met with guns, combat is the theme. And of course, it's remained that to Tarzan and Doc Savage and all the rest. This is called the bug-eyed monster, or BEM school of science fiction writing, which has the greatest appeal to adolescents and once dominated the pulps. We are told it is now spurned by the better class of science fiction writers, but don't you believe it. They're in there as hard as ever. Thus, beginning with a great scientist of godlike knowledge and uprightness as its central characters, science fiction soon discovered chinks in the armor and ended up with, in very short order, with the sinister figure of the mad scientist, either the making a Frankenstein monster he can't control or deliberately perverting his knowledge for power. The mad scientist becomes a stock figure, the great scientist. Well, he passed away because he was altogether too fantastic anyway. But this new book, it's just out now, it hasn't come to the bookstore yet, by Kahn and Wiener, called The Year 2000, published by Macmillan. According to the review, it said, it points out thousands of ways in which the world can go wrong and the very few ways in which it can go right. And the chances of it going right are extremely remote, according to these authors. Because, after all, how many wrong answers are there to a problem? Yes, as many as you want. How many right ones? You see, very few. Well, there are thousands of ways. This is what the science people are pointing out to us now in these things, in which the world can go wrong and only one right. There are millions of right answers. Well, there's the gospel, you see. Now here, well, here's some of the new stories. The end of the world theme and so forth. We won't go on these. Pilot lights of the apocalypse by Ridenour. These are by scientists. The military control of the push buttons brings absolute disaster. This is the reason. You see, they have the technique within it. They have the power. They have the ways and means within their control, pushing the button. But they don't know what's going on, really. And they don't know what's beyond that or what's that going to lead to. And so this story of Ridenour called Pilot Lights of the Apocalypse. Notice they borrow biblical themes all the time. And here's another one by Chan Davis, another scientist, Last Year's Grave Undug. Another after the Holocaust story in which the patrioteers have liquidated each other. It says the United States invaded itself. Everybody was had haunting fears that everybody else wasn't where they should be, and so they wiped each other out. And here's one by Leo Szilard, the famous Hungarian all-round genius who died recently, called Grand Central Terminal. It's the deserted Earth, everything wiped out because the Earth divided into two factions, Shiz and Coriantumr, and they extinguished each other, and that's his story. Well, this is the way science is writing science fiction now, you see. Here's another one by Chandler Davis called Adrift on the Policy Level. What can science do, he says? It's the hard way. Power and salesmanship. That's what you're dealing with when you're up against the corporation. Personality is the asset rather than becoming, say, a scientist. The world of the future is ruled by rhetoric. It's not the hardware. It's who controls that, you see. It's the salesman that's on top, he says here. And here's another one, Algis Budrys, called Nobody Bothers Gus, another of these alienation stories in which the human race is described as homo non descriptus, and this idea of why, you see. If we don't know why, what's all the use of all this fancy, these magnificent, shiny cities, materials, and everything else? What purpose, he concludes the story, what purpose did homo non descriptus serve, and where is he going? We don't know. And Robert Sheckley, who's most cynical and the most amusing, I think, of the present ones, on The Prize of Peril, ooh, a terrible story. Total degeneration of society expressed in a TV gimmick in which sides fight and exterminate each other. And here's one by Damon Knight, The Handler, in which the look is everything. And Asimov, who dabbles in all sorts of science and who writes science fiction, but he's had a lot of training and so forth, has written a great deal, but this one called Dreaming is a Private Thing, in which daydreaming has become a highly paid profession. People have become too lazy to dream their own, so people daydream and they make these tracks that are sold all around the country, so people have somebody to daydream for them, so it goes on. Here's Morganson, a psychologist, writes Coming of Age Day, compulsory sex gadget and so forth, and here's Lafferty, manipulating time ad absurdum and all these depressing stories you get. Now, an important theme here is the victory of the robot. The robot is the ultimate in automation, in regimentation, specialization, efficiency, exploitation. The robot works for everybody, you see. The robot does not, however, does not overpower suddenly. Humanity surrenders its functions gradually and willingly to the machine, is what we read from millions of robot stories. They're the favorites, as you know. The robot can move into a vacuum only after we have moved out. As soon as we have turned ourselves into robots, then we can be replaced by robots. This is the idea of the thing, see. The theme of thousands of science fiction stories. When men use hardware to control the world, its resources and other men, the hardware brings about destruction. I quote Mormon 8:37, for behold, you to love your substance more than you love the poor. We love our expensive hardware, here described by Mormon, more than we esteem the inexpensive software. With what result? Again, the old science fiction theme, destruction. Behold, the sword of vengeance hangeth over you, and the time soon cometh. Because you love your hardware, your substance, more than you love people. The steps to surrender to the specialization, despiritualization, a lot's being written about that now. Greenberg, writing on this subject, M. Greenberg, says the robot beginning with R.U.R., universal robot. You know, robot is a creature that does work for a highly specialized job and nothing else. Then he becomes the worker, he becomes the thinker, and finally he may even become the feeler. And this is the favorite theme of stories today, of robots that may have feelings. Do they or don't they? This is being discussed a great deal now anyway. And he says the growth of the robot continues until he ultimately achieves acceptance as an entity by his creators. The final phase is the inevitable ascent. In the inevitable ascent of man's servant is reached when man has disappeared and only a robotic civilization remains. A new cycle is begun when man is recreated by the beings he himself gave birth to. Thus the machine takes the place not only of man but of God. So we've replaced ourselves completely, you see, by these robots. We've done it ourselves. Now, this is old stuff too. It's a case of getting used to it anyway. In the Sutro Museum in San Francisco, you notice this great collection of 19th century clockwork people and so forth. They're robots, and they're just as impressive. They do all sorts of things. It's hard for us today to imagine the effect of clockwork man on 18th century thinking, but it had a great one. The Olympia in Amadeus Theodor Hoffmann's Tales of Hoffmann, the doll Olympia. She's just a pretty doll, but she runs by machinery and so forth. The doll becomes a monster as soon as it's accepted as a living thing. Until then, it's just a machine. But as soon as they accept it as a monster, the same thing with the golem, you see. The golem is just a machine that works. But when people regard the golem as a personality, the golem becomes a horrible object. This Frankenstein, the same thing. The tales of Poe and of Oscar Wilde, even. And, of course, Frankenstein. The monster is not a monster because of size, or it doesn't have to be terrible looking. I say the doll Olympia was a beautiful object, but it became a very terrible thing when people took it seriously. Writing in the Science Journal for June last year, the editor says, There's no danger of machine personality devaluating human beings or man suffering loss of innocence by understanding his own mental workings. The real danger, which is very serious, is the programming of people to behave like computers. It's all right to have, and this is what comes first, of course. And then he cites the case of the University of Michigan, where students have been conditioned to react to mere numbers with intense anxiety and other emotions and to have programmed dreams and so forth. And he says, if I were the parent of one of these students, I should be raising hell. I am shocked that the University of Michigan tolerated this. A contrast to this, Rudolf Anthus cites the case of an Egyptologist. There's a pharaoh in the old, well, it's a well-known story, a pharaoh in the old kingdom. And more than 4,500 years ago, a magician had performed that favorite trick of Egyptian scientists, namely replacing the head of a decapitated goose or duck so that the bird could give a couple of quacks. It can be done, actually, and this was considered a great thing. Someone of the court asked the king whether the magician whether the same could be done with a man, and the magician said it could. It was suggested that the thing be tried on a criminal who was sentenced to be decapitated anyway, but the king very indignantly vetoed it. He says, we don't do these things. A man may have been condemned to death for crime, but it was his prerogative to die with dignity, to pay the price and no more. Human beings are not to be subjected to this sort of thing, to be stooges for clever lab demonstrations. But a long way we've come from the old kingdom in Egypt, where a pharaoh refused to let a condemned criminal serve as an experimental animal when this guy says we have the right to play God and cut up anybody we feel like it. And here, in Asimov's very popular story called Lenny, the idea, he says, robots must be specialized. A versatile robot is a monstrosity. The point is that Lenny accidentally gets programmed the wrong way and begins to get human feelings. And this is the point of the story. But this is the whole business. An industry, we're quoting Asimov, an industry tells us what it needs. A computer designs the brain, machinery forms the robot. But the same industry also wants the same type of man, one reliable as the robot to do certain things and nothing else. And this is the theme, of course, of many things. So we're just taking his place. The, how science is weak and so forth. There are now 60, here's some figures for you. There are now 60,000 computers in the world, 40,000 in the United States, 3,000 in the United Kingdom, all built within the last decade. Also, Zara Colburn, who is hexadactylous, six fingers on both hands, sort of a freak, you see, extracted the cube root of 413,993,348,677 in 5 seconds, needless to say, in his head. Here we have a real science fiction figure, a physical and mental freak. Is the world any better off because of him? I don't speak disrespectfully. At the beginning of his famous discourse, Isocrates asks, if every athlete in the world could run twice as fast as he does, lift twice as heavy a weight, jump twice as far, hit twice as hard, etc., would the world be the least better off for efficiency? The world doesn't exist for specialists. The favorite theme is the superior efficiency of the robot built by other robots, so programmed that any mistakes or malfunctions are automatically corrected. Well, but we get to the idea now that the machines are getting more and more human, more refined, more complicated, sensitive in their reactions, until they may even begin to feel emotions. Robert Bloch's story called Almost Human is a good example about that. But with human emotions and human sensibilities, our robots, and human temper and tantrums and fears and misgivings and all the rest, come human fallibility. They're the very stuff of which human fallibility are made. Computers usually work with much greater accuracy than the human brain, says M.S. Sutherland, the British computer man. But if any element in a computer becomes faulty, then catastrophic errors occur. There's a terrifying story on this theme by R. Goulart called Terminal in the 11th Annual. Very good one. The robots get old, their relays run out, wires get disconnected and things, and then all hell breaks loose. This is the point, you see. But, says Sutherland, in contrast to this, except in pathological conditions, the brain does not break down completely, and although much information processing is done rather inaccurately, to say the least, the result is almost never complete nonsense. Whereas if one thing goes wrong with the machine, the result is complete. In other words, the machine, while it functions, is at best an idiot savant. That's a savant, these people who can do fantastic things, but do just that, you see, and do it very well if something goes wrong, like this man that could extract the cube root the way he did. If anything goes wrong, as things do go wrong in the material as well as the spiritual world, all is lost. Well, we give some examples of that here. Manipulation. Here, speaking of this very thing, there was a whole issue of the Science Journal devoted to intelligent machines, incidentally, and the editor writes here, I believe that diversity is rewarding in itself, and deplore the way in which the world is tending to a single universal culture, which used to be thought a great blessing, you see. This was the way, when I was in high school, this was the thing we looked forward to, a great universal single culture, and not even a very admirable one. I regard respect for life as the touchstone of ethics, and then he notes the 240 species of animals are now threatened with extinction. And you see, here's the gospel comes in too, because God has commanded that all forms of life should multiply and fulfill the measure of their creation, that every form of life might have joy therein. Well, how very different, you see, from coming on and saying, we'll just specialize in this or that or do that and so forth. Another award goes to Jack Vance, who wrote a story that's exciting. This, the usual thing, the mechs have revolted. This is a new story. You'd think it was written 40 years ago. Where the mech brain, actually the mechanical man, but it's from another world, we've been, made them work for us here. The mech brain falls short as in its lack of emotional color. One mech is precisely like another. They serve us efficiently because they thought nothing about their condition. They neither loved us nor hated us, nor do they now. Why did they revolt? That has a familiar ring, doesn't it? The answer is just as unoriginal as the question, because they do not like to be serving somebody else all the time, because the world is too small for two races, one exploiting the other. And this is supposed to be original science fiction. One of my children has a psychology book by A.A. Branca called Psychology, the Science of Behavior. On the flyleaf and covers are three photographs of a rat in a box. Never mind, the poor rat is almost certainly crazy, driven insane by the ways of science. There's a good article on that recently, that these animals are not living under normal conditions. They very soon lose their balance. You're not dealing with a normal creature at all in a maze. Never mind that. In the inky tracks that show his wanderings in the box, our school children are told we have a sure index to the workings of the mind. The genius of behaviorism was to discover that overt behavior is the only kind we can study. Therefore, to all intents and purposes, overt behavior was the complete disclosure of mind at work. It's the story of the lost keys. We look in this place not because we think we lost them anywhere near here, but because conditions for looking are much more convenient and comfortable than elsewhere. We search for the mind in a rat maze because it's easy to make mazes and put rats in them. But the psychology of science... Psychology, the science of behavior, is the equivalent of religion, the science of bells and steeples, or patriotism, the study of firecrackers. It is only the external aspects of the thing that can be studied. There, for the sake of convenience, we assume that the only external aspects exist, and of course this leads to trouble. But a big issue of today, and this is being discussed a great deal, is do computers think? I won't go into that, but a short while ago, this German science journal I get had an editorial in which they asked the question, this has started a furor over there. You have no idea what's been going on. A short while ago, this German science journal asked the question, does a tea strainer think? A tea strainer has one simple task to perform, but it's a task that requires making a decision. It must remove the leaves from the tea and let the liquid pass through. In this act of selectivity, the editor points out, the tea strainer does just what a computer does. So if a computer thinks, so does a tea strainer. There's a response from the readers, many of them scientists, was spirited. Most of the contributors vigorously defended the proposition that a tea strainer does think. Some felt, however, that the effect of this doctrine was not to exalt the tea strainer as a thinker, but to debase the mind man as an automaton. Others replied heatedly that simply showed their pride, arrogance, and pigheadedness. They would not admit that a tea strainer thinketh as a man thinketh, because they didn't want to believe it. Minsky, an electrical engineer at MIT, right, she says, our pious skeptics told us that machines could never sense things. But now that machines can see, he doesn't put see in quotes, you know, he assumes that they see. He assumes that, he just slips that in. This is an answer. But now that machines can see complex shapes, our skeptics tell us that they can never know that they sense these things. Do not be bullied by authoritative pronouncements about what machines will never do. Such statements are based on pride. How neatly the issue is drawn here. André Marois actually wrote a science fiction story, and it was based on the stubborn insistence of science, friends of his, who observed the behavior of social instinct of insects and animals and maintain that the creatures do not think. They admit that their behavior shows all the outward signs of intelligence and that they sometimes display amazing problem-solving capacities. They admit that, but they insist that no intelligence whatever is involved, taking the position of Bertrand Russell, quote, that animals behave in a manner showing the rightness of views of the man who observes them, not the animal itself. The rightness of their behavior and the correctness of their response is appreciated by the awed beholder, but the actors themselves are completely unaware of what they are doing. Now, these same scientists who unhesitatingly and emphatically insist that animals do not think, in spite of the clear thought patterns implied in their behavior, insist just as unhesitatingly and emphatically that machines do think, because of the thought patterns implied by their behavior. The electric eye that opens the door for you at the supermarket is able to think. In the best Watsonian sense, it gives a useful, sensible response to a definite stimulus. And what is thought but a matter of response and stimulus? But the dog who gives you a resentful, guilty look and scurries out of your way at the supermarket, of course, doesn't think at all. He seems to be aware he's not welcome in the store, but that's only your impression of the way he behaves. So the electric eye there that opens the door for that's thinking, but the dog has no thought at all. So showing that it's just a matter of your opinion and interpretation. Exactly the same sort of yea and nay was reached with the idea, the argument of the stars. Remember, the sophists said, look, the stars are just moving up there. That proves there's no God. Aristotle looked at the same stars. Look at those stars moving up there. That proves there's a God. I don't need any more argument. The very same evidence, and it's the same way here. You see a response to a stimulus? That proves thought, because it was an intelligent response. The tea strainer took out the tea leaves, as it's supposed to. Well, here anyway, there's a real possibility, writes Sutherland, that we may one day be able to design a machine that's more intelligent than ourselves, to replace ourselves as lords of the earth. The species could also, of course, be morally much superior to ourselves. Here we see the enormity of the misconception, or rather perversion. Take the early Christian idea of the ancient law of liberty. According to that, a gadget programmed in a way that avoided any behavior that might be called immoral would not be morally superior being at all. When Simon Magus asked Peter, could not God have made us all good so that we could not be anything else but be virtuous? Remember, Satan wanted to program everybody to be virtuous and nothing else. And St. Augustine later asked the same question in anguish. Peter replied, that's a foolish question. For if he made us unchangeably and immovably inclined to good, we wouldn't really be good at all, since we couldn't be anything else. And it would be no merit on our part that we were good, nor could we be given credit for doing what we did by necessity of nature. How can you call any act good that is not performed intentionally? Well, of course, that's the answer to this idea, that we could make a machine morally superior to ourselves because we program it not to do certain naughty things. Would you call that a moral machine? What an enormous gulf between this type of thinking and the gospel. In this same issue, incidentally, in which Minsky let out that blast about our pride and so forth, we won't admit that machines... There's a number of articles that say, here's one that says, the machine can understand normal, fluent human speech may never be built. This is a crew that was working on that a long time. And Lenin talking about Aldous, the machine that reacts at University of Texas, you know, that seems to have emotions, that reacts to inputs of fear, anger, or attraction, reminds us that it should be emphasized, of course, though it is diligently de-emphasized by most of us, that Aldous is only a model of personality, not the thing itself. Thus, when I speak of Aldous's fear, I refer to a numerical variable in the program that takes on different forms to represent different degrees of fear. The model or computer does not feel frightened, and he underlines that, any more than a molecular model made out of plastic balls and wooden dowels will enter into a real chemical combination. The introspection routine in Aldous can report on certain of its states because it was constructed to do so. It's not a pipeline to some ghostly inner world of the computer. So this argument goes on. But it's a theme of many science fiction stories today, as you know. Here, another man writing, this is George, this man George who's in charge of the program in England for computers. He says, Aldous simulates emotions, sometimes deceptively like the real thing. If you build an imitation human response into a machine, you've cheated. You have not done anything really interesting, however practical. Now, it's precisely this dissimulation that is the satanic part of the machines, just dissimulating. So we want to look out that we don't get programmed. Now, the basic characteristic of science fiction is its unoriginality. It is, as Miss Merrill says, a commentary on present conditions. What will happen if they're allowed to go on? As such, it can perform a valuable critical function. The stock theme of science fictions are the wonderful journey, including time travel, the wonderful invention, including the time machine, the end of the world, especially today, after the Holocaust, after the atom bomb, then beginning the new world and so forth. Big and little, we mentioned before, mere size, the conquest, the war of the worlds, galactic empires, strange visitors, including the bug-eyed monsters, and visitors better than people on our world, a story called Susan that got a lot of comment. The duel is a great favorite today. Magnificent fighting machine dueling to the last and wiping out, you see. Nothing else to think of but that. The duel, all kinds of duels, the last survivor, lights out and so forth. The breakdown of the machine, including the revolt of the robots. Strange worlds, usually pure description, far future or far away in distance. And a man coping with the challenge of strange environments, just descriptive. Or a boy meets girl. Humanity is the same in all environments. Man meets rival. And alienation, a great theme today, of course. Now, every one of these themes is biblical. This is the interesting thing. And often they use biblical terms in their titles, showing where they came from. Science fiction, with the advantage of modern science, thinks it can describe and interpret more accurately than the scriptures. I think the result is rather pathetic. So this is what's happening today. Now, this Aldous, who's editing this stuff in the latest anthology, says this. This is this one here. He says they're really running out of ideas. They've run out. We have nothing to offer anymore. He says, once daring assumptions are no longer daring. They are cliches. Originally, they had bold and imaginative thinking behind them. Now, they merely annihilate thinking. And here's an article in the last issue of Cosmos. This journal I get, I'm referring to that again. You seem to have quite the scientist. I get a German science journal. But the leading article is by Professor Werner Braunig, entitled 1968 Brought No Revolutionary Physical Discoveries. Compared with 57, 58, and 60, it was quite barren. Then Aldous goes on. He says, in the science fiction we're getting today, he says, we can't find... He's trying to get a good anthology. He says, you can't find any good stuff. The decay of language that always goes hand in hand with the decay of ideas is what we find. There's no science here, no imagination. Spaceship tales, robot tales, invention tales, these old themes roll forth, clad in dead language. Guys still fight over the last oxygen cylinder on Mars. The great, big, wonderful world of Western technology goes rolling on, but nothing is being done about it. Isn't it because the great, big, wonderful world of Western technology itself is plainly going nowhere? Not my own comment, you see. Science fiction, after all, is simply reacting to the emptiness of the material it depends on. The antics of Tarzan and Fu Manchu are almost perfectly representative of the time of science fiction appearing in the contemporary catalogs. The super brain and super brawn of man out-calculates, outwits, out-computes, hordes of robots and other monsters, mechanical or organic, and it's all on the level of naked power, right out of the world of the jinns of 1001 Nights. Isn't that the world we live in already? This is the science fiction that appeals to us, most. So we get the apocalyptic stories, and no matter how negative science fiction has become, it still can't be original. The worst you can think of has already happened, as far as that goes. Go into that. That wouldn't be science fiction, though. It really does seem that the effect of every major scientific discovery has been to make men lose their sense of balance, the sense of dependence on anything but themselves. The new physics, says Plutarch, a wonderful passage in Socrates, you know, talking about this, he says, when I was a kid and went to school, science knew all the answers. We knew that the brain was the center of everything, and we were on top of the world. We were just too cocky for anything. He describes that. Plutarch's talking about the same thing. He says, the new physics taught people to despise all the superstitious fears which the awe-inspiring signs in the heavens arouse in those who are ignorant of the real cause of things. From then on, the sophists carried the ball as ardent debunkers of all that was not science. The Milesian school claimed again and again to have discovered the basic principles and elements of all existence. In launching the program of modern science, Bacon announced that if he could just enjoy one season of uninterrupted work, he would be able to embrace all knowledge in a single system, to which he discovered the key. Newton's discoveries were held to answer all the essential problems of cosmology for all time. By a simple rule of thumb, Darwin explained forever the origin of all forms of life. Freud, by a single stroke, solved all our psychological problems. Grimm's Law explained the nature of all languages. The computers finally can solve all problems of any kind. It seems that every breakthrough is this. This is the immediate response, as Whitehead says. It's always the same old story. At last we have it. Even though we had it before again and again and again, and it turned out to be wrong. But no, at last we do have it. The most wonderful machines have already been invented long ago. We think of our computing machines as intelligent entities because we're not used to living with them, that's all. A punched card or magnetized tape, when stored away, we think of as memory. That's because of the novelty of the thing. We don't think a book remembers, even when it can be arranged to be opened automatically at a given item of information by pressing a button, like an address finder. Isn't that memory? No, we say that isn't memory at all. We've been living with that. But once upon a time, people thought it was. There was a time when they thought the book was actually a thinking machine and would think for you. And they thought it was just a miracle they couldn't get over. It was a tremendous thing. It took them a long time to get used to it. And then they realized the book wasn't actually thinking and remembering and doing all these things, that it was just you operating it. Those who didn't understand how it worked really believed that the written page itself was a thinking, living entity, just as we now think that a computer has a memory. Plato tells a wonderful story about this. He says when Hermes, who was Thoth, an Egyptian, he's talking about the Egyptian story, discovered writing, he went to Ammon, the father of the gods, in great excitement. He says, I've discovered a device that will infinitely project the power of the human mind, writing. Of course, it's tremendous. The greatest invention beats anything you can imagine. But he was wrong, as Ammon immediately pointed out to him. This will not aid men's mental powers, he said, but cripple them. It will seriously damage their power both to think and to remember. In the end, no gadget makes us better off. This may sound strange, but if we think of it, the purpose of every gadget is to liquidate itself. As it's improved more and more, it becomes progressively reduced in size, complexity, cost, and rarity, until in the end, the best transportation is that which requires no gadget at all. Gigantic transformers, cables, massive wheels, rails, enormous computers filling whole buildings, ponderous weapons, monstrous machines, all those belong to the essentially barbaric world. So science fiction, now experience is teaching us, and they're going into mental things, Paget, people like that writing about. The ultimate achievement is to do what we want to do without depending on gadgets. The best gadget is no gadget. Here's some stories on that. But now this idea of futility, Chad Oliver, these are new ones. This is, the hero says, "Hell, I sometimes think there's nothing as dull as constant, everlasting change. The devil of it is, there's just plain nothing new under the sun," to coin an inspired phrase. See? "There's nothing behind the door. There's just more of the same." That's what they're telling us now. Fritz Lieber, who's written a lot of junk, writes a story called Mariana with a closing line, "Annihilation brings unutterable relief." The idea, a favorite theme of Heinlein and so forth, when we solved all our problems, so we've licked the biological problems, we've even licked the problem of death and so forth, and then what do? We sit around and we're bored to tears, yearning for death, the only problem, the only thing we're trying to get now, because we have nothing to live for anyway. See, without the gospel, it's complete hollow. This is the surprising thing. And more stories on this thing. One called Traveler's Rest by Masson. There's this perennial war going on in the world all the time. Ordinary people bothered little about the war. Their spare mental energies were spent in a vast selection of play and ploys, making, representing, creating, relishing, criticizing, theorizing, discussing, arranging, organizing, cooperating. Well, that sounds like living. But it's all busy work. It's meaningless in the end. The theme of the book is futility. And here's one by Arthur Clarke, who's written so much stuff on it, called At the End of the Orbit. You can know what that means. And, it's boy meets girl in a Sputnik background. But here's one by William Morrison called The Feast of the Demons, in which people can make themselves get younger and older all they want. And he says they reverse entropy and people get younger and older and reverse forever and ever. And it's terrible, terrible, because nobody dies. And here's our old friend Isaac Asimov coming back again. The eyes do more than see is the net title of this story. There's nothing behind the door. He could dare manipulate matter before the assembled energy beings who had so drearily waited over the eons for something new. He fled back across the galaxies on the energy track of Brock, back to the endless doom of life. The energy beings could no longer weep for the fragile beauty of the bodies they'd once given them a trillion years ago. The worlds lose all significance. Notice, back to the endless doom of life. You're doomed just to more of the same. So when we go out in space, what do we find? Just more of the same we find here anyway. It's not as good. And what a disillusionment. So the splendors and high hopes soon shot their bolt and fizzled because they had nowhere to go. Science without religion, like philosophy without religion, has nothing to feed on. All true science, says Popper, is cosmology, and all cosmology is eschatology. It's my contention that any branch of human thought without religion soon withers and dies of anemia. In the symposium Life on Other Worlds, sponsored by the Seagram Whiskey Company, such scientists as G.B. Kistiakowsky, D.B. Michael, was a big thing, they got it up to 1965 it was, Harlow Shapley and others, Otto Struve, they went out of their way, every one of them, in a speech to show something that had nothing to do with the case, namely that the existence of life on other worlds at last is the definite final proof that we needed to rule God out of the picture. The immediate effect of scientific discovery was a sense of emancipation. We are on our own now. Now at last man can slough off the shackles of the past. God was all right for our ancestors, but we certainly don't need him in our calculation. Man is at last the master. A great deal of scientific experience as well as science fiction has shown that way madness lies. So this is a faith-promoting discipline after all. It's a wasteland, a heap of slag as far as the eye can see. Joyless, endless, monotonous, repetitive, empty but cluttered. A haunted universe. When we think that this project started out as a joyful and confident search for the best world or worlds that the human mind could conceive and bring into existence, and after generations of untrammeled and soaring imagination, this desolate city dump is what we've come up with, well, it just shows how far we can get without the gospel. Now, I have some, the time's up, we should ask questions now, but I have some ancient texts here that beat these things all hollow for science fiction. I mean, if you want these in science fiction, I'm going to read you some of them just the same. I'll read you a sampling of each one. These I've taken from... This is from the Berlin manuscript. It's a Syriac text. Here's the newly discovered epoch from Abraham. And here's from the Clementines, the Clementine. And here's from the Ginza. That's early Christian Mandean. Some of these are very good. I think they're good science fiction, too, so I'm going to read them anyway. Make this a recital, after all. I'm just going. Now, I've kept this quite as literal as possible, but of course I'm loading the dice all along here, you can well imagine, and so I'm doing the bossing. But, no, you can find out, this Berlin papyrus has been edited by, I have a copy of it upstairs, I have a Xerox on it, so if there are any questions, you can come and ask about them. This earth is littered with remnants, leipsana, it slips into the Greek word leipsana, with remnants of other worlds which have been mixed up in earth fire, in places where it's still possible, where it is still impossible for plants to take root. There are desolate places on the earth. He's talking about the forms of creation. This is supposed to be the Lord talking to the apostles, incidentally, showing how fantastic this is. Now he says, but what about the material that is still out there in orbit? The apostles ask the Lord. And he says, they still surround the earth in the sky, but they are not brought down into the common crucible. The word used is trench. There's a sort of circulating trench around here, and as matter is required, it's, according to weight, it's drawn off from this, and it's being purified by this circular motion here. And he says, it's first poured down upon the earth and then swept together and thrown into a pit, a sort of crucible. This is so that the fumes, this is a passage nobody understands, so the fumes can mount up and mingle with yet more elements which are to descend. Some sort of a process of feedback of some kind here. And then he says there are space waters out there too, but they have to be purified of certain poisoned elements of outer darkness. The idea that things that come from outer space are poisoned and must be decontaminated before they can be used in this earth is meant constantly in these old documents. This, incidentally, is from the first century. It's very early Christian document, first, early second century. Great advantage came when these fragments or vehicles, they may be called fragments or vehicles, were scrapped in the heavens. They were turned into junk because they were the remnants of other worlds and they're to be used again. They were swept up from earth and cast out to circulate among the worlds, where they would follow certain laws that would get them in motion again. There were various disposal areas. The Father emptied the three vehicles or vessels. Manjura means elements, actually. Manjura is the word that's used here. The three elements or vessels are what you call them. The Father emptied the three elements. They are, namely, water, dark, heavy stuff, and fire, which have to be used in all these processes from heaven. He empties them together in dumps at the edge of the firmament, or else he pours them out upon the earth. After that, they'll be swept away from the earth to some other place. Each is a deposit of stuff being poured out in a particular place where it's to be kept until it will be needed, and again clothed with the three forms of wind, water, and fire, which are the three great forces of metamorphosis and erosion that make a world. So you notice wind, this makes erosion, and heat, and water. Wind, water, the three great erosion forces. When they're used in a solid body, then he says we start making a world. Well, this sort of stuff you can dream about, you know. He revealed to me that this earth was established, how the sons of light came down in ships and purified the light and removed the slag and the aporoia, the stuff that is poured off. That's the slag, the aporoia, the stuff that melts, the scum that's taken off. What do they call it at the mill, you know, it's like, to a dump. They move it to a dump. There are five types of depositories from which five elements come as they're necessarily used. Some earths use more than another. What we call the elements, however, are the energy which is in all things. In the womb of the earth, the elements are gathered and fused and poured out. And so we get this amazing picture of a physical process of creation. We get dim visions. Of course, you may say, well, that's a mess, and it certainly is, but it's the sort of thing that Isaac Asimov gives you. I mean, it's as good as any science fiction you get today, considering when it was. And here's from an interesting one from the Apocalypse of Abraham. Abraham's taken with him. Now this, you see, the wonderful journey. Science fiction begins with the wonderful journey. Well, the whole field of testamentary literature and testaments, lots of new ones have been discovered recently. Any prophet you can name or any apostle has a testament. And the testament always ends with a great trip, a guided tour through the universe. And he usually gets in a vessel of some sort. And he carries around and he inspects things. And here it is in the Testament of Abraham. It's called the Apocalypse of Abraham here. He sees an indescribably their approach and he continues. In heaven, the angel arrives and they pass with violent winds to heaven above the firmament. And he sees an indescribably mighty light, and within the light there's a vast seething fire, and within there's a great host of moving, changing forms, moving within each other, of mighty forms that exchange with each other and constantly change their forms as they go and as they come and alter themselves. And they seem to call out to each other. There's strange, confused noises. And Abraham asks the angel, what's it all about? Why have you brought me here? He says, I can't see anything. I don't know what's going on. I've become weak. I think I'm out of my mind. The angel says, stay close to me and don't be afraid. The angel himself is beginning to shake, though. We're seeing too much. Then they were wrapped in fire and heard a voice in a mighty rushing waters. And Abraham wanted to fall down on his face and worship. But there was no more earth under their feet and nothing to fall on. And so he's in it. So they're just up there suspended. And then Abraham cries out with all his voice. And the angel cries at the same time, O God, O thou who hast brought order into this terrible confusion, into the great confusion of the universe, and who's renewed the worlds of the righteous. This idea that there is a power that actually can master these terrible forces, which just to contemplate them is absolutely appalling. I mean, you think of the forces that they actually should have been organized. Well, this is a thing that the great Catholic scholar who just died, the paleontologist, you know, what's his name? I'll think of it in a second. Says, look, man is the most refined being there is. He's much more complicated in chemistry and everything else than I keep thinking of Fustel de Coulanges, but it's like that. But he's far more complicated than a star, than a giant star, or a star system, or a galaxy. This must be the end product of the thing, and to be organized and controlled and be able to carry on like this, with all these terrible forces unleashed all around him. This is an appalling performance, see? And this is the story of Abraham here. He sees this and said, and yet there's a God who can actually bring worlds out of this, where the righteous can dwell. It's quite an idea. And here's one from very early Christian writing, one of the Clementines. And this shows that the legitimate questions, this is the earliest writing we have after the New Testament, as a matter of fact, that the questions that interested the early Christians were the legitimate questions they asked, and the questions that churches say, well, you're not supposed to ask that, but this is just the thing. Clement said he'd been to school, the university, and they couldn't answer the questions there, and the only person that could answer these was Peter. So he goes to school and he asks the questions, is there life after death? Is there a pre-existence? If we live after, will we remember this life? Why don't we remember the pre-existence? When was the world created? What existed before that? If the world was created, will it pass away? And then what? Will we feel things when we cannot feel now? Things we cannot feel now? He says he could not shake the immortalitatis cupido, the desire to go on living, from his mind. It was these questions, he said, that led me to seek for the true light. And you notice they're primarily scientific questions, but they are the basic religious questions too, aren't they? He's asking actually religious questions. They say, oh no, this doesn't have anything to do with religion. Yes, it says. We say, yes, it does. The doctors, he says, could not give him any answers. But they gave him a lot of clever talk, but nothing else. The pagan philosophers scared him when he was young out of his wits with stories of hellfire and so forth. That comes from the pagan schools, and he never learned that from the Christians, is hellfire. And then finally he goes to Palestine. He's a rich young kid, and he can afford it, and goes to Palestine, and he sees Peter during a conference of the church and puts these questions to him straight and gets his answers. And he asks, is the soul mortal or immortal? Was the world created? Why? Can it be dissolved? Will another world take its place? Will there be something better after it? Or will there be anything at all after this world? And then Peter explains to him how it is. He says, it's important that I find out these things. The important questions are, first of all, what came first of all? What was the immediate direct cause of anything, if anything? By whom, through whom, and for whom were things created? Of one, two, or many substances? How many substances are there? And whether these substances themselves came out of nothing or not, or out of something? If there is any virtue, and incidentally, the answers that Peter gives him to these are very interesting, but they're legitimate too. Well, we have a lot of these here. In other worlds, here's an interesting thing, the early Mandaean Christian writings. In other worlds, those in other worlds move with great, almost instantaneous speed, as quickly as human thought, so that in a single hour they reach a distant place. Their motion, however, is calm and effortless, like the rays of the sun passing between heaven and earth. Now the Father ordered Hebelzebub, that's Abel, to make a world and to place Adam and Eve in it, and the three angels of glory and light should come down and instruct them and visit Adam and keep him company. God said to the pure sent one, who was to lead this delegation, go call Adam and Eve and all their posterity and teach them concerning everything about the King of Light and the worlds of light. Be friendly with Adam and give him company. Give him company, you and the two angels that will be with you, and warn them against Satan. So the three angels are instructed to go down and teach Adam the law of chastity. And Adam was told, "We will also send helpers to those of your progeny who seek further light and knowledge from us." And this was the principle that was given to them. But this business of the beings visiting the other worlds, now there's a lot on that. Here the evil one complains about this. Here another version says, "He sent down the sent one to help men and help them get back to his presence where they had come from. And he spread a table for Adam and Eve, and he instructed them there." And then the evil ones complained, and they said, "The children of men have taken over the earth. They are strangers who speak the language of those three men who visited them. They've accepted the teachings of the three men and rejected us and our own world. So they plot against us. And they say that Mandadahaya is coming to give them aid and support." The evil ones say, "These three men are in this world, but they are not men, but they are beings of light and glory. They're trespassing on our territory. They have come to this little Enosh, this little man who is helpless and alone in the world. After leaving this world, to instruct him and to give him an advantage over us." You see, the evil ones complain. Well, this is the very stuff you read about in science fiction all the time, but it's written up beautifully in these old sources, and there's so much of it. Ships with ropes of light, with crews clothed in light, is laden with a treasure, and it's going from one world to another, and the evil ones waylay it. They pirate it. And they came out of I do not know where. This is the Pseudo-Thomas, a recent and very old discovery. The evil one came out of I do not where in his ship, and he hijacked the cargo and divided up the treasure among the worlds over which he ruled. Now, this is your galactic empire motif, you see. The world over which he ruled. He planted precious plants in those worlds, the plants he had stolen. He fixed precious stones in their firmaments, and they gloried in their stolen finery. Well, God found out about that, and he sent a messenger to get back all the stolen stuff and replant the plants in their proper worlds for which they had been destined in the first place. And this is described in very physical terms. And he says, "Prepare your people to receive and reclaim and disinfect all this stuff that they've stolen from us so we can put it in the worlds for which it was designated." And this messenger is reason. He's the son of light himself, but he is a real person. And so he goes back and he gets the stuff back and puts it in the worlds where it belongs. But see, it's in this borderland between scripture and... Now here we have Coptic stuff. There's a lot of Coptic stuff on this particular... Now here, for example, how realistic this is. From the place of your inheritance, Spirit Adam is told here, from the place of your inheritance, the sun will look like a little tiny grain of flour. That's how far away it is from this sun, he says, and there's nothing. The distance between the other worlds is vast, and their size is enormous, and there is a hierarchy among them. And every one of these worlds is ruled on a single pattern, however, though no two of them are alike. There's always a governing body of 12. Wherever you go, every topos has 12 rulers over each part. And each world, whether it's awaiting occupants or whose names have not yet found their place or have not yet been assigned, or whether it's already occupied, is governed on the same plan. And every kingdom requires a space, it says. So we have to go down and find a space to build a kingdom. Well, it goes into all these things, and there's some very intriguing things here. The number of it. My father laid his hand upon my head and gave me the name of Hibbeljabba, and he created for me a world containing 10,000 times 10,000 light worlds of light with 360 mighty inner Jordans, and every one of these had 360,000 Uthras, and every Sakina had 360,000 Sakinas, and every world was different. It gives us descriptions of these various things. 1,000,000 mysteries, this is from the Manichaean prayer book, 1,000,000 mysteries and a myriad planets, each with its own mysteries, preceded this world. During Yahweh's great discussions of the new creation that were to take place, he sent down envoys to report to him how things were going on. They did not send all the Uthras, nor did they teach them all the worlds, but this is the usual order, it says. Uthra after Uthra will teach thee, will take thee by the right hand and will show thee worlds and dwellings and treasure houses and so forth. In the ascension of Isaiah, there's an interesting thing here. It says, this is one thing that the devils don't know. He says they're banished to particular places and they're not aware of how much really goes on. They miss all the show, he says. And the devils say, we are alone and there are none beside us. They have the illusion that the human race has had for a long time. Well, we've taken up enough time with this, and if there are no questions, I think we can... Naturally, I can't answer any scientific questions, and naturally, any questions about fiction, I can slough off, I mean, get rid of. Oh, very interesting. Yes, I said some of these things. Well, anyway, it's too late to go home. Hey, it's got to bear my testimony. Can't stop without this. Now, do I need to bear my testimony? Now, what else is there but the gospel, brethren and sisters? If I didn't believe it, I jolly well have to, but I don't believe it for that reason. I believe it because it's true, and I hope we all get testimonies of the gospel in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.